Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 489, an interview with Robert Perry. This is being recorded on December 5th of the year 2004. Once again, it's my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airwaves Robert Perry, the author of, among other titles, Secrecy and Privilege, The Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq, and that book will be the focal point of our discussion. Robert, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Well, thank you.
As we're speaking on 12-5-04, there is a lot of public discussion about the questionable election results here in the United States. There's been a fair amount of controversy. You have certainly covered that in on your consortiumnews.com website and been lambasted by, among others, the Washington Post for doing so. But one of the points that you make in Secrecy and Privilege is that the Republican Party has a long history of dirty tricks, in particular, dirty tricks in presidential election years. This past presidential election year saw a major focus on the Vietnam War, an event long past, but because of George Bush's role in the Texas Air National Guard and John Kerry's role as a war hero, it came into sharp focus again. It's sort of ironic, but one of the things that you talk about in Secrecy and Privilege is the interference on the part of the Nixon campaign with some peace talks that might have at least attenuated the conflict, if not ended it. I wonder if you would go into that in some detail for us.
Well, sure. In 1968, of course, it was a fairly tight race between Richard Nixon and Vice President Hubert Humphrey. Humphrey was trying to succeed his president, Lyndon Johnson. And Johnson had been forced out of the race himself because of the Vietnam War and his failure to prosecute it effectively. So he was trying to bring it to some kind of conclusion before the election in 1968. There was an effort to have all sides get together in Paris for peace talks. Johnson was hopeful that this would be a breakthrough, that he'd be able to bring the war to some kind of conclusion. Obviously, that also might have helped Humphrey in this close race. So it was to Nixon's disadvantage to have those peace talks go forward. Now, all that was sort of known at the time, and we also knew that the peace talks collapsed. They collapsed because the South Vietnamese government, the government of President Tu, had refused to attend them. So while the communist side was willing to attend them, and Johnson wanted to have them, his Saigon allies balked, and the peace talks collapsed. Nixon was able to eke out a very, very narrow victory over Humphrey and really, in a sense, change the direction of American politics for years to come. Now, at the time, although the American people didn't know this, the Johnson people did know that there were back-channel communications going from the Nixon campaign to the Saigon government. Often they were being handled largely by Anna Chenault, who was a Chinese-American and who was working for the Nixon campaign. And her message to the Saigon regime was that if they held off and didn't cooperate with Johnson, that the Nixon administration would give them a better deal. And clearly, from the point of view of the Saigon regime, which only was standing up because of U.S. backing, the idea that any kind of peace talks probably would have led to their collapse. So President Tu agreed not to show up, and the war went on for another 4 or 5 years. Now, since then, more and more details have come out. The first real break in the story came when Cy Hirsch did his book on Henry Kissinger. And he included a section on these 1968 dealings because Henry Kissinger played a background role on Nixon's behalf. Since then, additional material has come out. There were intercepts of the Saigon of the South Vietnamese embassies, messages back and forth to Saigon that were made public in the 1990s. And so as bits and pieces of the story have emerged, what we've learned is that Nixon was willing to play with the lives of 500,000 American soldiers who were on the ground in South Vietnam for political advantage. And that although Johnson got wind of this, he did not make it public at the time, partly because he didn't have the whole story, and partly because the fear was that since Nixon won, to bring this all out would have caused great dissension within the United States. So the Democrats largely kept quiet. Some of them have talked about it since, but really not until many years after the fact. And so the American people really don't know this whole story. And fairly recently, when Vice President Key, who was the South Vietnamese vice president, did his memoirs, he also included a segment on this initiative from the Republicans to get the Saigon government to pull out of the peace talks. As a result, some 30,000 American soldiers died, along with many tens of thousands of Vietnamese and Indochinese people. So this was a case of absolute determination to put gaining power in the United States ahead of even the well-being of American troops.
It's interesting to ruminate on that. 30,000 would put more than half of the total combat deaths. The people whose names are up on that very moving wall fell after these peace negotiations were sabotaged.
Correct.
Something you note, I would add just in passing, that this, something of a pattern has obtained that when these Republican abuses, or I would say at least outright treason, take place, very frequently the Democrats play the good scout, and they decide in the interests of national unity and patriotism, et cetera, to keep quiet. And then yet the Democrats get portrayed as the traitors and the Republicans as the patriots, and that is, shall we say, a less than complete picture.
It is ironic, and it has been a pattern that you can trace back to 68, and it recurs as in Secrecy and Privilege. I show that a number of Democrats have played this role, even during the Watergate period. There were senior Democrats who were trying to sweep the Watergate scandal under the rug, in the name of national unity, and not to have that go forward. There were enough Democrats who did fight for the truth. And, of course, the courts intervened as well. So a good deal of the truth about Watergate was forced out, and Nixon was forced to resign. But the pattern has continued, and we see Democrats choosing not to bring out some of the dirty tricks that the Republicans have played out of fear that it will undermine the confidence the American people may have in the electoral process, or it might cause dissension within the government and prevent them from getting certain bills passed. There always seemed to be some reason, some excuse, not to simply get the facts out and tell the American people the truth.
One of the personalities that you chronicle throughout the course of roughly two or three decades of American political activity in connection with this is a guy named Spencer Oliver, and he actually noted that the Clinton administration just basically was very naive, and they didn't realize who the people were that they were keeping in power and what they would do. Spencer Oliver crops up in connection with the Watergate affair. Now, in 1968, we just covered the Nixon campaign's interference with the peace talks between the Johnson administration and the Vietnamese. 4 years later, once again, there was subterfuge with regard to the presidential election campaign. And you go into a lawsuit that followed the Watergate affair's exposure and how this obtained to an attempt by the Nixon administration to see to it that George McGovern's weak candidacy would not be derailed. That's kind of a tortuous way of putting it, but I wonder if you would highlight the Texas connection, or the Texas gambit, we might say, and Spencer Oliver and how this obtained to the Watergate lawsuit.
Well, Spencer Oliver is an interesting character. He plays a key role in Secrecy and Privilege because he crops up in a number of these moments. And his role during the Watergate period was he was the one guy who was working for the Democratic Party at Watergate whose phone was actually bugged. What happened in Watergate was that the Nixon burglars went in. They went in first in May of 1972 to place wiretaps on a couple of phones. One of the phones they chose was Spencer Oliver, who was a young staffer. And the other one was a tap to be placed on the phone for the Democratic National Chairman. Now, the only bug that worked was the one on Oliver's phone. So they were picking up information that he was involved in, some personal stuff they picked up. His marriage was breaking up, so they had a lot of gossip about him. But they also found out that he was part of an effort by some moderate Democrats to try to head off McGovern's then growing chances of victory. If we look back at the whole Watergate scandal, part of it was that Nixon wanted to sabotage what he considered the strongest Democrats, the ones who might give him trouble, people like Ed Muskie, and sort of funnel the Democrats into the weakest candidates, including George McGovern. So Nixon was really wanting to match up against McGovern. The efforts among some of the more establishment Democrats like Oliver was to see if other choices could be made to avoid the McGovern choice and to have a Democrat who might have a better chance to beat Nixon. So that's what the Republicans were picking up on the bug in Oliver's phone. And part of the strategy at that time was to go to Texas, where there was going to be a convention, a state convention, to pick delegates for the Democrats, and try to prevent McGovern from getting any delegates from Texas. So that was what Oliver was discussing with other Democrats. But when he went down to Texas, thinking that he'd have a pretty easy time of trying to shut out McGovern, what he encountered were Democrats who were close to John Connally, who had been the former governor, who were urging that McGovern be given his fair share of delegates, and so this plan was destroyed. And Oliver ran into Bob Strauss, who was a senior Democrat at the time, who was also close to Connally. Connally had switched over by this point from being a Democrat to being part of the Nixon administration, and was actually heading up some of the Democrats for Nixon in 72. So you had here this strange situation that Oliver couldn't understand at the time, because they seemed like they knew what was coming. And so the pro-Connally Democrats were essentially handing the nomination to McGovern in Oliver's view. So he didn't know what to make of that, but it's what happened. And he then, a month or so later, finds out that there's been this break-in at the Democratic National Committee. There was a second break-in. The first break-in had gone undetected. The second break-in was to make sure that some of the bugs that weren't working began to work. They wanted to place more in and to fix the ones that weren't working. And that was the moment in June of 1972 when the burglars were caught and the scandal began to erupt. At first, though, for quite some time, it was not known that there actually had been a prior break-in, and that there had been intelligence being gleaned off of at least one of the phones in the Democratic National Committee, Oliver's phone. It wasn't until so subsequently it's learned that there was this earlier break-in, and Oliver becomes a key figure then, both in the lawsuit that the Democrats tried to bring against the Republicans for this espionage, essentially a wiretap violation, and he comes under pressure later. After Nixon wins his landslide victory in 72, Bob Strauss, the Texas Democrat, wins a nasty battle inside the Democratic Party to become the chairman of the Democratic National Committee. Strauss then turns around and begins to pressure Oliver into withdrawing from the Watergate lawsuit. Strauss wants to end the Watergate lawsuit, and he wants to essentially make amends with the Republicans. He moves the Democratic Party out of the Watergate because he doesn't want to remind people of the incident. He's acting in ways that would seem quite unusual if you looked at it from the point of view of what's good for the Democrats in a partisan way. He's acting really to help out the Republicans. Simultaneous, by the way, to Strauss's emergence as the Democratic National Chairman, Nixon turns to a former Texas congressman named George H.W. Bush to become the Republican National Chairman. And Bush and Strauss, both Texans, both well connected into that world, and both of whom have relations with John Connally, the two of them begin working on this effort to sweep the Watergate scandal under the rug. Ultimately, it fails. Oliver refuses to go along. He is then forced out of his job with the Democratic Party, and is punished for not acceding to these requests to help the Republicans protect their flanks on Watergate. And Strauss continues to try to settle this matter even into 1974, when the story is really beginning to unfold. But then the Urban Committee in the Senate has examined this. John Dean has come forward and made public statements, and the story is beginning to unravel in ways that nobody can really control anymore. And despite the best efforts of George Bush Sr. and Bob Strauss and others, the truth finally comes out, at least to a great degree, and Nixon is forced to resign.
This did, however, put George Bush right into the mix, and was one of a number of examples of George Bush's helping to orchestrate not only some of the machinations that subverted the electoral process, but also the cover-up of same. 8 years later, in 1980, of course, there was another gambit, something called the October Surprise. We touched on that in our first interview, Robert. I wonder if you would encapsulate the October Surprise, give us delineate the outlines of that investigation or gambit, and then talk about why that didn't come out. Because you relate a very interesting series of individuals and facts that indicate that, in fact, the people who were investigating or quote investigating October Surprise were conflicted. They had conflicts of interest, which attenuated the investigation.
Right. Well, again, in 1980, the Republicans. Well, first after Watergate. In 1974, the Republicans were dealt a serious defeat. They were clobbered in the Congress. By 1976, with the defeat of Gerald Ford, who was seeking to win the presidency on his own, they lost essentially all the positions in the government. They lost. They were out of the Congress. The Democrats of the House, the Senate, and the White House. So that was a very low moment for the Republicans, and they began their efforts to rebuild their strength, largely or in part by bringing together conservative media and other means to make their case more effectively, to attack reporters. There were all kinds of new groups being formed at that time, which have become very powerful in the years since. But by the time we get to 1980, Jimmy Carter, the Democratic president, has been struggling through a number of crises. There have been oil shocks. There's high inflation. The economy is not doing too well. But one of the issues that is on everybody's mind at the time is the seizure of American hostages in Iran, which occurred in November of 1979. The efforts by the Carter administration get those hostages out become a focus of almost a national obsession through 1980. There's an effort to mount a rescue operation in April 1980, which fails. There are renewed talks at different points, especially in September of 1980, and ultimately those do not work. The hostages remain in through the election of 1980, and actually the anniversary of the hostages being taken happens to be the same day as the election in 1980, and Reagan defeats Carter, and of course his vice president is George H.W. Bush. The hostages are finally released on January 20th, 1981, literally minutes after Ronald Reagan takes the oath of office. Now, despite the peculiar coincidences here, people did not really make much of this for some time. It wasn't really until the Iran-Contra scandal began to break, which I was involved in writing about for the Associated Press in 1985 and 86, that there begins to be a focus on, well, when did these contacts with the Iranians really begin for the Republicans? And as we learn more and more, we discovered that the contacts actually went back to 1980, and by early 81, shortly after the Reagan presidency began, literally days, the shipments of weapons begin to go to Iran. This did not just begin in 1985 as we had initially thought, but really can be dated back to the very first days of the Reagan administration, often being handled through the Israelis, There actually was an Israeli plane that was shot down over the Soviet Union carrying weapons, American weapons, to the Iranians, and it was at the time essentially covered up, at least in terms of the significance of it. So we have this, we learn these facts. The question becomes, well, how did they start and who started them? And some of these stories began to spill out. There have been about maybe two dozen or so witnesses of various types who have spoken about their various roles in these contacts. Some of them are reasonably credible. Some of them are fairly prominent, including senior officials of the Iranian government, people in the PLO, including Yasser Arafat, the head of French intelligence, Alexandre Desmarages, as well as people who were sort of less known but who were more players on the ground, an Israeli intelligence officer, for instance. And so if you look at the body of this evidence, it's actually fairly significant. And what we have pieced together, and what I try to go through now in some more detail in Secrecy and Privilege, is to lay out the evidence and the facts and the chronology of how this thing unfolded, and bring in much of this new evidence, including much of it now, which is now documented even, including testimony that was given before a House panel, which was basically kept secret, and a report even from the Russian government, which chimed in with a report which was kept secret from the American people as well, saying that indeed the U.S. the Republicans had engaged in secret contacts with the Iranians back in 1980. So the basic storyline, as it has emerged, is that the it appears that the initial motivation of the Republicans in the early part of 1980 was to find out what was going on. Bill Casey had been appointed the head of the Reagan campaign, and he was a former spy master from World War II, and a person who just wanted to know as much as he could to avoid any surprises that might hit him in the campaign he was running. So he basically begins making contacts. He knows there was a business associate named John Shaheen, who also had been a former spy from World War II and still close to the CIA, who had this Iranian business associate named Cyrus Hashemi, who happened to be a person that Carter was using to help try to arrange the release of the hostages. So there's this back channel that was set up through Casey and John Shaheen and Cyrus Hashemi to begin not just spying effectively on what Carter was up to, but allegedly making his own set of contacts with the Iranian leadership. We also know that on the side of George H.W. Bush, who was first running for president against Reagan and then became his vice presidential nominee, Bush used people who had been in the CIA, because Bush had been CIA director in 1976, and had gotten very close to a number of CIA officers who were cashiered effectively during the Carter administration, who were very bitter and wanted to get payback, in effect. So some of them, including Ted Shackley, the legendary blonde ghost of a number of prominent CIA operations of the 60s and 70s, was one of Bush's operatives who was making his own set of contacts and finding out what was going on. So those efforts, which were essentially intelligence gathering initially, evolve over the summer of 1980 into a relationship with the Iranians that seeks either to settle this matter early and therefore make it not an issue for the election in November of 80, or as things drag on, to make sure that Carter is not able to get the hostages out right before the election. And now the evidence is overwhelming, I would say, certainly very strong, that kind of understanding did evolve with the Iranians and the Republicans over those months, and eventually was settled when after Reagan came in. By then, the terms had been pretty well nailed down, partly in the post-election contacts with the Carter people. But the Iranians were then willing to let the hostages out as long as Carter got no credit for it, and they handed them over essentially to Reagan, and made it was an important boost for the early Reagan-Bush years to have this patriotic surge that followed the release of the hostages. And Reagan was able to present it as if the Iranians were scared of him. There was the joke that was going around Washington, basically, what's 2 feet deep and glows in the dark? And the joke was that that's Tehran, you know, a minute after Ronald Reagan becomes president. So that it helped create this image of Ronald Reagan as someone who was tough, who instilled fear in our enemies, and could get things done. And that was very important as a way to give the Reagan-Bush administration momentum as it went into its foreign policy initiatives of the 1980s.
This is something, this October surprise is something that's delineated at considerable length in your book. So listeners who would like to flesh out some of the details and see exactly how this was done, hearing about people such as J. Stanley Pottinger, one of Hashemi's associates, and also a good friend of George Bush, can get a very detailed presentation of this in the October surprise discussion, that portion of Secrecy and Privilege. Robert, we're almost out of time on this side. What I'd like to do is we'll begin side two with discussion of how this got covered up. Because certainly one would imagine that something of this importance, certainly the fixing of an election and I would say treason, would come out, and yet it didn't, and there are reasons for that. Before I'm going to give some information about some of the websites in which people can hear this interview and get a description of it. But tell us about your website. Tell us about Secrecy and Privilege in this holiday shopping season. Where can people order the book?
Well, there is a way to go to a direct website for the book. It's called secrecyandprivilege.com. That's one word, Secrecy and Privilege. And there are some details about the book, information about the book, and as well as a way to order it directly online. It's also available through Amazon.com. It's offered by some bookstores, but it has not gotten wide distribution in the bookstores, so it's probably easiest to get it online. Also at ConsortiumNews.com, which is a website that I've been involved with since the mid-1990s as a place for investigative journalism. People can go there and connect through to get the book.
All righty, and I want to remind listeners of the Spitfire website, www.spitfirelist.com. There are long descriptions of all of the programs and lectures available that I've done over the years. In particular, in the For the Record section, there are long annotated article-length descriptions of each For the Record program. Also links to two websites maintained by sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey. More recent For the Record programs, roughly the last 4 years or so, are archived on streaming Real Audio at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery, one word, DaveEmory. Older programs are available for download only, also on Real Audio at a longer URL. Link to both that address and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website, again at www.spitfirelist.com. We've been visiting with Robert Perry, the author of, among other titles, Secrecy and Privilege, The Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq. We will be joining Robert again inside two of this program, and we're going to continue with our discussion of the October surprise and why this hasn't made more of a splash than it has. For Robert Perry, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening to Side 1 of For the Record program number 481. This has been recorded on December 5th of the year 2004. And again, my name is Dave Emery, and thanks for listening.